Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock, live from Heritage Radio Network here in a shipping container adjacent to Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, we have a conversation that I hope you find interesting. I certainly do, and I think it's delicious, and it's a conversation about taste, which I think is something we don't talk enough about in our culture. And today, we're going to talk about taste with someone from a different culture, although certainly familiar with ours, among many things, maker of a great wine, Quercia, one of the great wines of Italy, one of the great biodynamic wines of the world, and so much more than that. Sebastiano Cosia Castiglione, welcome to Brooklyn.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Mitchell. Thank you for the great introduction. I don't know if I deserve that much praise.
You deserve more. I just wasn't quite sure how to articulate it, because to call you a winemaker obviously is one thing that you do, but actually you are a wine connoisseur and a great, observer of human nature. And I think that that's going to be, I hope that's where our conversation gets us today.
Absolutely. I would love to for our conversation to go there. And there's one topic I'd like to touch right away, if it's okay with you.
Please, it's your show.
Biodynamics, there's so much confusion about it. You know, most people still wonder what it is all about.
And yes.
Maybe we should spend a few words about
I would love to, because we're actually calling this episode A Taste for Biodynamics and Other and Alternative Modalities, and we'll get to those modalities later. But
okay.
But so when someone says a biodynamic wine, which you have not always said your wine is, which I think is interesting also, even
yes.
though it has been for some time.
Yes.
What do we mean?
Biodynamics is an advanced form of organic agriculture.
Okay.
And what it does is it tries to bring back the balance that nature would normally have if it were untamed. Into the to the plants and to the ecosystem where the plants grow. And it does this in many ways, which are pretty interesting. For instance, it specifically in viticulture, mm-hmm. you know that, of course, you cannot have rotation, which is would be the most natural way to manage agriculture if you wanted to it to be healthy.
Meaning some things grow and then they die and other things grow. And
yeah, or, you know, rotation, actually, if you divide your land in pieces and mm-hmm. you keep switching what grows on each piece. But with vineyards, of course, you can't do it because they grow in the same place for 50 years.
Right.
So one of the things that biodynamics does is it uses cover crops, these you know, plants that are grow every other row,
mm-hmm.
and it simulates rotation because there are plants that otherwise would not be growing mm-hmm. among vineyards, and they replenish the soil and nourish it and give it back all the substances that the vines absorb year after year. And this is probably the most important key to biodynamics, although a lot of people talk about, you know, the cow horn and the manure
right.
and the this
and the that. Moons and all that, right?
Yes, and we will go into that. But yeah. I think cover crops are really the key. Imagine that, for instance, our cover crops are a mixture of 32 to 36 different seeds, and you have plants from mustard to all varieties of legumes and flowers and aromatic herbs and this mm-hmm. and that. And every plant plays a role. It mm-hmm. absorbs something from the soil, and at the same time, it gives it back. Legumes are an obvious example. Mm-hmm. You know that they give nitrogen back to the soil, which most other plants absorb. Mustard, for instance, has an antifungal effect. Hmm. So it diminishes the chance that your plants are attacked by funguses, for instance, which is fascinating to me.
I think we need to take a step back before we're even planting grapes and remind people what happens when something grows. That actually what's in a plant comes from somewhere. If we believe Newton and matter, mass is not created or destroyed, which I think some people perhaps in Tampa at the Republican National Convention might not believe, depending on who you ask. But if we believe them, then what we take out of there is literally taking things out, the nutrients, the sustenance that becomes the grapes. And viticulturists have known for years that the that you need stuff there to put it in your glass eventually, that there's something that ends up from the ground.
Absolutely. And this opens the whole question of terroir and and what grapes and wine therefore taste of, because if you absorb from your soil, and the flavor in your grapes is what comes from the soil that your vines grow in, then obviously you can talk about terroir. If, as it is in most cases, and you know I like to be controversial, so I will just say some things, but in most cases, in conventional viticulture, what happens is the vines are nourished with synthetic fertilizers. These are mostly produced, these are mostly byproducts of oil. So imagine how wonderful. And one thing that has been observed over and over is that plants that are nourished with fertilizers on the surface tend to have roots that turn upwards towards the surface of the soil. Because, of course, the nourishment comes from there. Right. And you literally see plants with curved roots that are curved up. Our roots in a biodynamic and organic environment, but especially a biodynamic environment, tend to go very deep down. So we have measured some of our plants with roots as deep as 14 meters, which is whatever it is in feet.
30, times three, yes. Right. 40 feet deep.
40 more. Feet deep. And it's fascinating to think that, you know, a fundamental difference arises in taste in the grapes, right, and therefore in the wine, between a plant that nourishes itself exclusively from the soil and what it finds in this soil, and another one, the conventional one, that basically is eating synthetic fertilizers its whole life.
From the top.
So when I hear, you know that all of us wine producers tend to say the same stupidities over and over. Everybody will mention the terroir and how careful they are doing this and doing that. Well, I challenge that idea. If you use synthetic fertilizers or fertilizers of any kind on the surface of your vineyards to nourish your plants, I put that your wine will never taste of that terroir because it comes from something else.
So let's talk a little bit about the taste of wine in general. I mean, you are a great connoisseur and collector, and what in a glass of wine, what are we tasting? I mean, what does terroir mean? But also, what is a good glass of wine in your opinion, vis-a-vis
taste? That's a great question. I say that a good glass of wine is, of course, a wine that tastes interesting, that tastes good, that has a sense of place and a sense of history and a sense of breed. And so what I find interesting in a wine is when a wine tells me a different story. You could use a metaphor and think of a crowd where faces are all the same, or a crowd where every face is different. And of course, the latter is more interesting. And with wine, what I'm looking for, when I think of an interesting wine, I think of a wine that tells me about where it comes from, tells me what the environment is around it, and tells me a story. And unfortunately, nowadays, most wines are made by, it's mostly Australian winemakers that imparted this direction, but winemakers that try to replicate the same wine all the time with certain characteristics that we know are pleasing to Robert Parker and so forth. And, and all these wines tend to taste the same. You could put them in, you could taste them blind and you wouldn't be able to know if they come from Australia or from New Zealand or from France.
Right. Well made, let's say, but generic.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely. Generic. And take, for example, a wine that I had last night, but that I think we also had together, Daguenau's Silex. This is a fantastic Sauvignon Blanc from the Loire. Daguenau has been one of the pioneers of biodynamics. And this wine has a wonderful fruit and flower bouquet. But what is astounding about it is the mineral component, which is one of the great advantages of biodynamic wine. The roots go deeper. There's more mineral flavor in the grape, in the juice, and in the end, in the wine.
I remember you once describing a German wine we were drinking as a glass of rocks, which
absolutely,
I thought was such
absolutely,
a great...
Absolutely, which is very much the case also with this the Silex I was talking about. And what's fascinating to me is that you take a German Riesling, and there's a certain mineral component, and then you take Daguenau's wine from the Loire, and the mineral component is completely different. Mm. You could not confuse them. Mm-hmm. And they are so unique and so special that you can always identify them, which is one of the things I look for in a wine.
So I wonder if the generic nature that the wine business has gone, the generic taste they've gone towards, explain a phenomenon. I recently was in Copenhagen and had spoken about that experience on the show, where there's a fascination for quote-unquote natural wines, which to me tasted more like apple cider that had turned slightly than they were cloudy like that than some of the wines that we've enjoyed together. Can you describe that phenomenon?
Well, very simply put, good intentions don't always yield excellent results. And so you can make so-called natural wine, but not just because of that it's going to taste good. You need to be a good winemaker. And it goes back to something you mentioned before. We have been organic since 1988 at Querciabella, but mm-hmm. we never mentioned it for years and years and years. And then we turned to biodynamics in 2000. And again, we didn't talk about it so much. But more recently, because, you know, the point was making an excellent wine, mm-hmm. not making, you know, it's not a niche marketing gimmick.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But more recently, I feel there's a need to tell the world that we need to take a different route. We need to go a different way about things. And so we've made it a point of explaining what we do in detail and trying to encourage other people to do it. And if you'll allow me to be controversial again, I am not a man of compromise. I hate compromise, mm-hmm. and I hate hypocrisy. And when I hear people saying we use chemical products just a little, the minimum necessary amount, you might have heard of a genius last week who talked about legitimate rape. There's no legitimate rape. Mm-hmm. And if you rape the earth, you rape the earth. That's how it goes. And so you can, you know, there's no such thing as I'm poisoning you, but just a little bit.
Right.
If you use chemical products, you're poisoning the planet, you're poisoning the plants, you're poisoning your final product.
Right.
And in wine, it is demonstrated that you find find traces of pesticides all the way onto the shelf. Amazing. Of the supermarket when you buy the bottle or the wine store. The traces are there, and you can clearly tell that pesticides have been used and residues are there, and they will stay with you for the rest of your life if you drink that, which I think is very alarming. Unlike other products where the residues are
peeled away
in small quantities.
Right.
Exactly. Or, you know, or you wash them from the surface of this and that. In wine, the residues stay. So beware, you drink and you absorb what you choose. And
okay, so I hope if you're listening, you know, throw out a few things from your cupboard. If you are listening and have some questions about winemaking, about biodynamics, about rape, perhaps, call us at 718-497-2128. You can also write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or tweet us, especially if you're listening to a podcast, at Taste Matters HRN. I'm talking with Sebastiano Cosia Castiglione, who is, among other things, the owner of the great Querciabella winery in Chianti. Let's talk a little bit about the wines in particular and your winemaking process, just because there are many people who listen to this network who are interested in wine. The show that precedes us is all about wine. Before we get on to some other topics, what do you do? You're in the traditional Chianti region. So let's talk a little bit about...
Yes, we are in the Chianti Classico region, and we make wines, reds mostly from Sangiovese, but we also make a very special white from Chardonnay and Pinot Blanc,
mm-hmm. and called
Bata,
yes, which is hard to find here. I know, because my husband likes to find it whenever he can, but it's
absolutely
hard.
Absolutely, I have a hard time finding it too. But you know, it just it flies off the shelves when it's there. What we try to do is of course, according to what we said before, mm-hmm. wines that are very faithful to their terroir. And I feel that especially Sangiovese can be treated in many different ways. And instead of doing something generic, we're trying to really find the flavor and the history of the place, which is why I started this project recently. I don't even know if we have discussed this before, but we are starting a single vineyard Sangiovese from different areas of Chianti Classico, pursuing what I call a Burgundy project in Tuscany. For years and years and years, all the Chiantis have been made by blending grapes from the whole region. Mm-hmm. And imagine, it's as if you went to Burgundy, and instead of having the beautiful terroirs, you just mixed everything and made one wine.
Right.
And so what I'm trying to do now, I have acquired vineyards in several of the key places of Chianti Classico. So there's Ruffoli, of course, Panzano, Gaiole, San Polo, and all beautiful places, Radda. Mm-hmm. And they're all very specific. They taste very different from each other. And so what we're going to do is bottle these single vineyard wines, 100% Sangiovese, just to show how different these wines can be from each other. And the goal of the project is to get to a point when we have six different terroirs, and there will be a case with six bottles from the six different places, and you open the bottles and you taste the vast differences between one terroir and the other.
Well, while we dream about that case of wine, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Taste Matters.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese, made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow, with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And point of origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. Got Stitcher? Heritage Radio Network is on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and we are talking with the owner of Crecciabella Winery, a great winery in Chianti Classico, with the owner, Sebastiano Cosia Castiglione. Before we get back to our conversation, I want to remind people listening that Heritage Radio Network is now a membership radio station like NPR, and if you like what you hear on the wide variety of shows and podcasts and all of the great things that the people here provide an opportunity to hit the airwaves, and I would encourage you to think about attending the members-only party on September 9th here at Roberta's Pizza. We're in Bushwick, and there'll be a great selection of foods and cocktails and beers right in the heart of the Brooklyn food movement. You can read about it on heritageradionetwork.org. Your tickets to the event include a membership to the station, and I know that they would love to have your support. Less than the price of a good meal or a fine bottle of wine, you can become a member and support conversations like the ones we are having. And I'd like to take this conversation, Seba, to a different place, because you make these grand wines, I would say. There's something so bold and elegant about the taste of them. And often we think of that style of wine as accompanying a rich steak, beef-filled meal, and yet you are a staunch vegetarian, and not just that, but a real advocate against meat, against unethical animal raising, but in animal raising in general, and the consumption of animals,
yes,
and use animal products, and I'd love to hear more about that.
That's a very good question. Well, first of all, yes, I have to reconcile the fact that I make wonderful red wines, and some of our best customers in New York City, for instance, are steakhouses.
Yikes.
And the fact that I am vegan at home and vegetarian socially, and it's an ethical choice, as you mentioned. But I have to say that I don't miss any of the flavors that are left out. And as you know, we as Squarciabella organize special events that focus on vegan and vegetarian food to showcase the wines. And so far, we've been very successful.
Right.
In fact, people realize that when they eat a nice, healthy, and ethical diet, they feel so much better. They have these amazing dinners with 16 or 20 courses, and they get up from the table and they feel fine. And they've had wonderful wines that don't poison them and don't give them a headache.
Right.
And they've had very healthy food. And I think it's a way to go, but there are very deep reasons apart from taste to make this choice, which we also make in agriculture. We might want to touch on that, but I think we left off the biodynamic subject without going
yes.
into some of the most mysterious aspects, and
they
some
pertain
of these
to this
are,
too. The cow yes. you mentioned the cow horn
exactly
yes.
the cow horn buried in the ground and all the weird stuff that we at Squarciabella do not do. And you know, I'm an atheist. I hate astrology. I have no patience for New Age nonsense. So all of that, you know, dancing naked under the moon to make good wine does not belong to my view of the world. But what we have done at Squarciabella, because of the reason that raising animals is unsustainable. Again, mm-hmm. there's no legitimate rape. There's no partial raping the planet. The numbers are very clear. There is no way you can raise cattle without damaging the planet, without mm-hmm. killing the planet, in fact. And we know now that raising cattle is listed by reports of the United Nations as the number one cause for the emission of greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. So there's no question there. It's obviously unsustainable. So what we have done at Squarciabella is reinterpret biodynamics and create all the preparations that are sprayed on the vines in biodynamic procedures, producing them from plants.
Wow.
So there's no cow manure. Everything is done with green manure, mm-hmm. so specific plants that we grow ourselves and that we macerate and that we treat in certain ways. And these are transformed into the basic preparations that we use in our biodynamic fields. And so imagine a cycle that is absolutely complete, no outside resources. In our fields, we grow the plants that we use to nourish our vines, and it's a closed cycle. And this, of course, contributes to the health of the planet, and no animals are involved, neither in the agricultural part nor in the cellar.
Interesting. Wow. And I don't even... I'm a little bit speechless. I'm a little bit speechless because we think of a sort of a bucolic time when there was a cow and two chickens and a field and a garden, and sort of that was a unit that... perhaps was sustainable, certainly more sustainable than any giant farm or any, you know, I don't
sure,
know.
That was when the world population was one
right.
tenth what it is now.
Right, of course.
Maybe. And we're still talking about exceptions because, you know, the rest.
I mean, of course.
Most of the planet never had that balance because the population was already, overgrown.
So what you're doing, I mean, it's in the heart. I love that you exist in Chianti Classico, famous for a particular steak, let's say, a giant steak, and
absolutely.
also a sort of almost a Disneyland, albeit real and authentic, mm-hmm. but a Disneyland of a time and a place of a sort of fantasy existence, and yet you're applying a very modern, almost superbly technological solution to go back to another time. I mean,
absolutely.
There's a fascinating paradox there a little bit.
Absolutely.
There are
many reasons to do that, and it's true. We are saving a heritage that has been there for thousands of years, you know, referring to moon phases for certain agricultural procedures, for instance, which is regarded now as if it were superstition, but quite the opposite. There are many there are numerous interesting scientific studies on the influence of lunar solar gravity onto the life of plants. And I'll mention one particular scientist, Mr. Peter Barlow, who has demonstrated over and over that the influence of the sun and the moon on the life of plants is the most important influence there is. And I'll give you one very short example. They've done these studies where they lock plants into a dark place, no contact with the air, no light, no interference from outer sources. And these plants kept moving every few hours, and nobody could understand what was driving this. And then it was shown clearly that it was moon phases, and that these plants were influenced by this during various times of the day. And this is the driving force behind the life of plants, the most important force behind the life of plants. Wow. So the fact that we would use this as our ancestors is for thousands of years to guide our agricultural procedures seemed to me to be perfectly natural, logical, and smart, while completely denying it as if it were superstition is absurd, especially facing scientific evidence.
You are making me think of Thomas Kuhn and the theory of scientific revolution and the idea that there are two ways to look at science, that either science is progress and is taking us away from something, or science is trying to catch up to what we've known for millennia and can only begin to understand how it works. And it seems increasingly, let's say, or at least we're in a moment where science has to catch up to what other people seem to know, and a few people like yourselves and leaders in other movements have had the wherewithal and the confidence to just go it alone anyway and let it catch up.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting juxtaposition.
And to touch more on your saying, let's talk about the world and the planet and a general view. I know we are talking to an audience that is very sensitive to sustainability and everything that makes sense from the ecological standpoint. And I would like to propose an idea. When we think of our ethical sphere, of course, the main goal is to expand it. Mm-hmm. But being more specific, we now know, for instance, that it doesn't make sense to limit your ethical sphere to a small geographic area. We now know that everything we do influences the rest of the planet. So we no longer think that our ethical sphere can and must only include those near us or the region where we live, but we know that we influence the whole planet. Another major advance, another dimension in which our ethical sphere has expanded is time. Mm. We now know that whatever we do now influences future generations and has an impact on future generations. And I would like to propose that the most important dimension that we need to expand our ethical sphere in nowadays is species. We can no longer consider all other species as slaves to our needs. Mm. We have to try and make an effort to enlarge our ethical sphere to include as many species as possible. And this will make our ethical sphere more balanced and more consistent than it is now.
Well, there is a challenge to you all. So not just, let me paraphrase. So man, and I'll say man purposefully, ain't on top, that we're actually part of a larger picture that includes plants and the soil and all these other things. I mean, every other species that's around. What do you think? So, and do you think vegetarianism is the most effective, immediate way to express that?
Yes, and I would say that veganism is probably the best way to face the problems the planet faces nowadays. You must have read a couple of days ago of these new studies by the Swedish scientists about the waste of water that demonstrate clearly, numbers at hand, that there will not be enough water to keep feeding the planet the way we do. And unless they propose a 95% vegetarian diet, and in fact they mean plant-based, so it's vegan, a 95% vegan diet, the whole planet, there simply will not be enough water to feed all of us, and there will just be a huge crisis.
So one of the issues that keeps coming up, because I find myself in conversations about this all the time, at the Beard Foundation we're working on sustainability in the large global sphere. And one of the questions that keeps coming up is that for so long as a civilization, and I know, and we have 1 minute to get here, so as a civilization, we have created a model of progress and advancement and just of progress in general that includes meat. You know, you watch every culture become richer and meat consumption goes up, or you become, you know, we've created a model, and maybe it is the American model, but I think it predates us. I mean, and you go back to France, you go back to other societies. What is the model for ambition for cultures that is not meat?
Well, there's ways to look at that. Not everything that is part of our history is good and should be repeated over and over.
Of course.
And so, just like we have given up many other awful aspects of the growth of civilization, yes, in brackets, including slavery, including neglecting the rights of women, and including all other aspects that were clearly completely wrong. Now we have to advance in a new direction and consider that meat cannot be part of progress because it just simply isn't sustainable from the ecological point of view, but also from the ethical point of view.
A lot to digest. And we have one question and maybe time to get it in, even
Absolutely.
Though we're about to go over time. And it is a question about how, besides modeling what you do, can we encourage vintners to transition to biodynamics?
What we can do, which we already do, is sit with many of them. At Quechabella, we have a program. We invite, agronomists from all other friendly wineries that are not organic or biodynamic. And we sit together, we taste wines, we talk about the practices, and we try to show them where to go. And many of them have responded in a wonderful way and are adopting the new techniques because they see the results. Mm. And the way to achieve, I think, any result and to guide someone to follow an example is to give a good example and to show the results. And if the results are good, then the direction is the one to take. And many people more will adopt it.
Fascinating. Well, if people would like to learn more or certainly follow you on Twitter, I'm going to spell it because we're pronouncing it the Italian ways. It's Quercibella, at Quercibella, Quercibella. I would encourage you to drink it. You might even want to try to stop by if you're in the Chianti area. It's a very different winery experience, and I can speak as someone who has said that I would never visit another winery because you've seen one stainless steel tank from UC Davis, you've seen them all, and Quercibella is different. I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Next week, just to prove that we are an equal opportunity radio show, we'll be talking to Jake Dixon, who has a butcher shop in Chelsea Market called Dixon Farmstand Meats, and it's an ethical, sustainable, grass-fed whole animal butcher shop, and we will perhaps continue this conversation about man's relationship to other species. And I thank you so much for listening. Remember that if you're listening to a podcast, you can tweet us questions at Taste Matters HRN. I'm Mitchell Davis. Eat something delicious and think about where it came from. I'm going to try a different one every week now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is the most trusted media outlet for real, quality conversations about food. That experience will come to life at our first annual members-only fundraiser party on September 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Enjoy the best food in the world from talent including Michael Anthony, award-winning chef from Gramercy Tavern, Brooks Headley, award-winning pastry chef from Del Posto, Shauna Pacifico at Back 40 West, sustainable seafood from sea to table, and much more, including drinks made by Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues, craft beer from Greenpoint Harbor Brewery, wine from Cane Vineyard and Winery in the Napa Valley, and plenty more. Radio is back, and this will be a special, exclusive experience in the back garden of Roberta's that you don't want to miss. September 9th, 5 to 8 p.m. Buy tickets at heritageradionetwork.eventbrite.com.